right, I'm walking and I'm talking, and I'm Richard Dugan, and this is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices, knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Today's going to be a fun show because it's something, the subject is very broad, but we're going to get to some specifics as well, and it's one that I have a lot of fun with, learning about. And my guest in studio today is Mark McIntyre. He hosts his own radio program right here on this station called Minds That Matter. And I have to say that I really, really enjoy listening to you. Mark McIntyre, Minds That Matter. And there are only a few people I would even attempt to mimic. There's a gentleman of a religious persuasion back in the 80s. This is Reverend Bob McElroy of Ontario. I don't know where I'm going with this, but
it's a great compliment to be mimicked.
With all these, what is it they say? The greatest
imitation is the greatest form of flattery.
Yes, exactly, okay.
Right.
And of course, we've had a great opportunity to sit and chat over at your favorite restaurant here in Santa Barbara, Opal.
That would be Opal, yes. That would be Opal. Hello, Richard.
It's good to have you on the program. We're going to talk today about philosophy. We're going to talk today about what it is and isn't, as well as its role in our humans' evolutionary process. I find it interesting, as I have learned what little I do know about philosophy, and you being a philosophy instructor at UCS at Santa Barbara City College,
correct?
You can rattle off the names of the great philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them go back as far as the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any earlier than that? Of 5 or 6 or 10,000 years ago? Or
oh, yes.
I mean, how far back does philosophy go? And maybe a better question would be:
that's a good question.
What is philosophy? I know the definition. I looked it up on Google.
Mm-hmm.
What is philosophy?
Richard, first of all, it's a pleasure to share your audience, and it's very kind and gracious of you to invite me on the show. You have many opportunities to have minds a lot greater than mine, and I really do appreciate it, because we have had some wonderful conversations. I do listen avidly to your own show. The last show was on the Indian astrology show.
Mm-hmm.
And then I listened to another one recently on, you were discussing atheism. So your content and my content, and I suspect, although I do not know, but I suspect that our listening audience probably does overlap to a great degree.
I would think so.
Yeah,
I would hope so.
So I hope that I bring some more listeners to your show, and to your listeners that don't know me, I say a warm good afternoon.
Absolutely.
And it's a pleasure to tackle this topic. I've been teaching philosophy professionally, that is to say I get paid for it, since 1967. Continuously and consecutively since 1967. I received my formal education in philosophy at Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., and Georgetown University. And my first teaching assignment as a professor of philosophy, I was 23 years old.
A wise 23?
Well, I don't know. I think pretty stupid. 23 and teaching philosophy, I have to admit, looking now back at it, I was too full of myself. But the kids loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, the students loved it, because I was younger than some of them.
Yeah.
And I could slap arguments around. You know, I could do that. And they thought that was kind of cool, even in those days. But to get to your question, which I think your listeners, especially your listening audience, I think... might find very interesting. Since you looked it up on Google, you know that the word itself, the etymology of the word philosophy, it comes from two marvelous Greek words, philos, sophia, two words which means lover of wisdom.
Mm.
That's literally what it
yeah.
means. The Greeks have a marvelously rich classical assemblage of words. More words for one meaning and more meanings for one word than we do in English. Philos, as opposed to eros, erotic love. If the Greeks were talking about erotic love, they would use the word eros.
Mm-hmm.
If they were talking about intellectual love or love of ideas, they would talk about philos. And if they talked about fraternal love, brotherly love, familial love, love of one's country, one's society, they would talk agape. Beautiful word, agape. And the love of God would also be agape. So, first of all, the word itself means one who loves wisdom. Notice that philosophy has nothing in its definition that says we got all the answers, guys. Come over here.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's alien to the philosophical spirit. As I have been telling my students all these many years, the great value of philosophy is not the answers that are given off occasionally by notorious and infamous philosophers. The value of philosophy is the questioning that it raises in the mind of the student that studies philosophy. Most of the people that I respect in philosophy, in the history of philosophy, would agree with that statement. And I refer to from Socrates to Bertrand Russell. Unfortunately, philosophy has sort of gotten off the rails, and I hope we can get into this today.
Mm-hmm.
Philosophers have not been doing their duty, and they have allowed other people to come in. And I know you're looking at me quizzically, Richard, but they have not been doing they have not been fulfilling their responsibility in the academic world and in the cultural world and even in the civic world. They have failed recently. After World War II, things changed dramatically, and even between World War I and World War II. We'll get into that.
Mm-hmm.
But to just bring you back to your original question, the value of philosophy resides in the questioning, the lifelong questioning of four basic concepts, and this is the subject of my next book, Reality, Truth, Goodness, and Beauty.
Mm.
Think of philosophy as a compass. Okay. Think of it as a journey, but not a destination.
Okay.
Think of it as imagine in your mind a compass, but instead of north, south, east, and west, it's reality, truth, goodness, and beauty. And if we head one way, we notice the compass points, let's say, to truth, and we tend more towards cultivation of ideas of truth. And yet, if we move another way, let's say we go to an art museum, our mind tends towards the understanding and the questioning of what is the beautiful. And if we go to a courtroom and we hear a trial in progress, and we hear people talking about good and evil as criminal acts, well, the mind then bends, the compass then bends towards goodness.
Mm-hmm.
But we also realize that you cannot attenuate yourself to any one of the four without assuming something about the other three.
Ah. And you could be making a false assumption about one of the other three, which then throws your whole premise off.
Philosophy is all about assumptions. In fact, I thought of a book concept that I'm probably never going to get to write because it's a monumental mammoth task.
War and Peace has already been written.
This is when I tell you about this, and I don't have any qualms about announcing it because mm-hmm. if anybody wants to go try to do it, good luck to you, Charlie.
Yeah.
It's called The Book of Assumptions.
Oh.
And the Book of Assumptions, Mikhailo Klein, one of my students, who was on my show, by the way, mm-hmm. on virtual ethics and special problems, I've handed over to him and to another one of my students, Matthew Bixby, who's now in England, doing the English semester for Westmount College. And I've turned it over to them. You know why? Because they're young.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why this is a young person's work.
Mm-hmm.
The reason is because the Book of Assumptions, it will take every single academic discipline and it will drill down, drill, drill, drill down, asking why, until you get to those fundamental assumptions at the base of each academic discipline that presume about reality, truth, goodness, and beauty in order for that discipline to function.
Well, I can say that there's an assumption that people have made and they perpetuate it by continuing to state the phrase that you cannot change another person. Mm-hmm. I have recently learned you can. You change another human being by changing yourself. Now, it's an interesting paradox because if one goes within oneself and starts to work on oneself and do these different things, or if one chooses to go to a class and learn something new, or chooses to take a trip somewhere and then come back, all of the relationships that he has with all of the people around him, from the closest to the farthest, he is changing these people because he's coming back with a newness of himself, a newness about himself. And so he is changing other people. So I've come to see that at least in a not in a conscious way, but in maybe a subconscious way, I am changing the people around me every time I do one of these programs, mm-hmm. because I leave this and I go out and I've got all of these things going on in my head from the conversations, from the interviews, and then they pop up in the conversations mm-hmm. with these people that I've associated with 5 years, 10 years, mm-hmm. 20 years, what have you. And then those relationships are changed. Mm-hmm. And then those people go off and they change the people that they know.
Yeah.
And it is sort of a ripple effect.
Right. So change is one of those ambiguous and equivocal terms.
Right.
I teach critical thinking and writing, mm-hmm. and actually I'm going to assign this broadcast to my students to study and have them review it, because I only teach online now, and they never get to meet me. Well, unless they have a scheduled conference, and some of them do.
Yeah, because I was actually going to, I was thinking, wouldn't it be cool just to sit in on one of your classes at UCSB?
Yeah, well,
or at SBCC.
SCC. Well, I might get the chance to return if the economy improves and mm-hmm. we get more scheduled classes.
Yeah. But you have a book right now that's available online.
Right. That's it. My textbook for my class. Mm-hmm. I teach Philosophy 111, which is called Critical Thinking and Writing, not to be confused with the English 111 version, mm-hmm. because we approach the subject matter in an entirely different way than the English department does. And so if you take the philosophy version, you are taking reasoning, argumentation, and refutation. And that's the name of my book, Reason, Argue, Refute, How to Think About Anything. And what I teach my students is the Aristotelian method of reasoning that was codified. Aristotle didn't invent logic, but he simply codified logic.
Yeah.
And I teach my students how, when they're finishing my class, they can formulate a valid argument on any topic in any discipline, and then they have the power to investigate whether or not the argument is not only valid, but mm-hmm. is also sound,
okay,
which is another question.
Right. We'll go into that. We'll also go into a question I have for you that I sort of raised in our pre-program conversation that we had, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back here on this program. You are getting new paradigms for your new world.
What do you want to do?
I don't know. What do you want to do?
What do you want to do?
I don't know. What do you want to do?
Let's just say you've developed that higher desire to do something different.
And let's just say you've decided to penetrate downtown Santa Barbara.
This time, do something different.
Roy!
Roy, the downtown exception to all that is tattered. Roy. A full bar, behind the scenes, and strangely unique.
Roy, open till midnight. That's right, open till midnight in downtown Santa Barbara.
Roy!
You can stoop to Murder Burger, Taco Dog, or Donkey Hut.
But if you've developed that burning yearning,
that haunting taunting,
that itching twitching for something different,
I mean really different.
Roy!
Roy, open every day, 6 to midnight.
That's right. Open till midnight.
Roy, 7 West Korea, downtown Santa Barbara.
It's downtown.
It's different.
Roy, open till midnight.
You have a message that others can benefit from. A meditation to share. A talk to give that you want heard by more than just those present. A workshop, seminar, presentation with speakers whose information, insight, and inspiration can help others to break through to their highest potential and purpose. Making a quality recording is the first step to making it available, and fast forward is the right direction. They'll bring the recording studio to you. Your message is important. It needs to be recorded by professionals who share your passion and want to provide quality recording to those who want and need to hear it. Call 805-708-9804 to take that first step. 805-708-9804. Call Fast Forward for all your recording needs on location and in studio. 805-708-9804.
Do know how you feel.
Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. We stream live on the internet at richarddugan.com. We also archive these programs. I know there are lots of names for that audio and video that's stored up on the servers where your website is. It's archived. Okay, you can call it iPod. You can call it podcasting. You can call it whatever you want. It's archived. Okay. let's keep it simple. As a matter of fact, keeping it simple here with Mark McIntyre, my guest, we're talking about philosophy. We've defined it as the love of wisdom by virtue of the etymology of the word.
Very good.
Word.
Yes, very good.
But you said something interesting, and it also has, and the question that I have for you goes all the way back for me to my early days in broadcasting at the Christian radio station, where when I started asking the great questions, I was told that I should go read the words of the founding fathers of the faith because they answered those questions. And two questions came up. Who set them up as the founders of the faith? What made them authoritarian in position that we had to listen to them and accept their answers to these questions as truth? Then the second part was, and it wasn't so much of a question, it was more of a conclusion on my part. Maybe it's false conclusion. I don't know. You can correct me on this. I must fall into the ranks of the founding fathers because independent of knowledge of them, I was asking those same questions. Didn't necessarily have the answers, but I was asking those questions and searching for those answers. You made a comment about Aristotelian
logic.
Well, who set Aristotle or Plato or Socrates up as the great philosophers? Weren't there philosophers before these guys?
excellent question. And I hope we can get back to your theological
conundrums. We might do that.
I'm not a theologian, although I have played one on TV, but I am not a theologian.
I've never played a doctor on TV, but I would like
to get back to those questions. But I want your the question you're asking me is fantastic. I couldn't have paid you enough money to ask that question. No, seriously.
Go ahead.
Okay. And the answer to your question is very serious. And this goes back to another question that I didn't fully answer, so let me do it. Philosophy comes along very late, comparatively speaking, in the evolution of the human species. The first inclinations that we have that humans have enough time to ponder reality, truth, goodness, and beauty, which is the philosophical temperament, doesn't come until we see drawings on cave walls. That's how far back philosophy really, really goes. And when humans have the necessary leisure time, in fact, there's a marvelous book called Leisure Time as the Basis of Culture, and I highly recommend it to you. Leisure Time as the Basis of Culture. The predicate of this book is that it is only when we stop hunting and gathering and stop killing mammoths and have enough time to sit by the fire, you know, have a cigar and a glass of wine while we're eating wild boar, you know, and the wife and the kids are asleep and we're gazing up the stars. And, you know, the guy next door lives in the next cave comes over and says, you know, what the hell are we here for? Why are we doing this?
Yeah.
You know, the philosophical temperament was very slow to develop and grow. It needed the nurturing of leisure time. As more and more leisure time increased, we see the first inklings of what I call storytelling and the oral tradition of the various groups around the globe of human types. That's the earliest reckonings we have of philosophy. The roots of philosophy come from stories. Out of those stories come mythologies.
Okay.
Because the more people congregate into villages and regions and then finally into cities, stories give rise to myth. Myth gives rise to religion. Religion gives rise to philosophy. At least historically and chronologically, that's the way it went. Now, the Greeks Bertrand Russell makes a great point of this in his History of Philosophy. It's a mammoth volume, and I highly recommend it to my students and anybody, actually. He makes a great point about this in one of the early chapters, that what sets the Greeks apart in their golden age, and we're talking, oh, somewhere between 500 BC and maybe 200 BC, that golden period there, was that the Greeks, unlike us, had no problem allowing their theology to exist side by side with their philosophy.
It didn't necessarily merge.
No, but it never conflicted.
They never conflicted.
Okay. And the reason Russell supposes, and I think that there's merit to his argument, the reason Russell supposes that this is the case is because the Greeks, unlike us, did not inherit a top-down theological structure that repressed other ideas. But rather, they inherited a myth. Their roots were mythological, and if you have mythological roots, you're much more willing to understand and entertain alternative points of view. Essential to being a philosopher is the ability to appreciate points of view that you don't yourself have, and even those points of view that you yourself oppose.
Well, then it makes sense that the period between, as you phrased it, between World War I and World War II, and even after World War II to the present, it's very clear to me how philosophy has sort of not been derailed, but has derailed itself, because we don't have the time to sit and ponder unless we're independently wealthy, mm-hmm. or we are living up in the mountains in a cave somewhere, and we know how to hunt and fish and care, you know, do the hunting gathering thing to survive, mm-hmm. and we can spend that time pondering the mysteries of the universe, mm-hmm. whereas most of us, we're going from day to day, running back and forth, just trying to earn enough money to pay mm-hmm. the rent and electric bill and the mm-hmm. and the grocery bill, and going right. to the store and filling up the gas car with gas, and
right.
we don't take the time to slow down.
Right.
I want to throw something else into the mix, and that is philosophy and its role. You mentioned that the path was religion, then philosophy.
Yes.
Where does spirituality come into the mix? Do you see them as the same as religion, spirituality and religion, or are they different? And how does that mix in with philosophical constructs?
It's one of the best questions you could ever ask, and I hear you asking it in different ways around all the shows you do. It's a great question, and many people confuse religion with spirituality. Many people, unfortunately, have been victimized by bad priests, bad nuns, bad ministers, bad rabbis, people, for instance, who only wanted the power exercised through the cleric robes and not the principles upon which they're based. There are many wonderful, fine clerics, many wonderful people who practice their religion. But unfortunately, there have been so many people who didn't that people have been turned off to religion because of the agents of the religion. That is like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Religion is not the same as spirituality. Mm-hmm. Spirituality is an inclination. It is a temperament that one either has or does not have. Mm-hmm. It is not a set of beliefs. It is not a set of tenets. It is not a set of precepts. It is a way of searching. It is a way of understanding. It is a way of communicating. But it is not a set of dogmas. Religion is a set of dogmas, tenets, precepts, principles, values that advocates subscribe to or do not subscribe to on a voluntary basis.
I find it fascinating that this conversation we're having, and I love getting into these kinds of conversations with just different individuals. And it used to be in those early days, those first 10 or 12 years of my early part of my career, mm-hmm. where it wasn't a conversation. I would get up on my soapbox almost to try to convince them, whoever they were, of my position.
Mm-hmm.
And then I began to realize that that wasn't real productive.
Right.
That was not very helpful in
right.
fostering relationships and understanding
right.
and cultivating new ideas and concepts.
Can I flesh out a little bit of what you just said?
Sure. And then we're going to take a quick break.
Go ahead. How much time do I have? About a minute?
About 2 minutes.
Okay, I'll make it real quick. One of the things that is very interesting when you study philosophy is that you get into an understanding that if a topic is philosophical, it is not scientific. And if it is scientific, it is not philosophical. Okay? Mm-hmm. Let me explain that. As soon as speculation becomes verified by empirical testing, empirical verification, it ceases to be philosophical and passes into the body of knowledge that we call science. But yet at the same time, at the root of any good scientist is the recognition that they do not know the absolute truth and they do not have the absolute last word on any topic whatsoever. They have the best available evidence that backs up their valid arguments. That's all they have. And that's quite a bit, by the way. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that the reciprocity between philosophy and science. This is why philosophy was once regarded as the queen of the sciences. I don't know if you're aware of that, but it used to be the duty of philosophers to ride shotgun on all arguments in all disciplines. That's why people are awarded PhDs, Doctor of Philosophy Economics, Doctor of Philosophy History, Doctor of Philosophy Physical Science. The PhD is supposed to mean, it doesn't anymore, by the way, but it's supposed to mean that you have made a philosophical contribution, something that no one has contributed before to your discipline.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that anymore. Today, the PhD is largely a union card.
Mm. Well, there is, of course, the other definition we won't go into right now.
We all know what that one is, Richard.
Yes, we do.
Right.
Well,
does that help?
It does.
Yeah, okay.
It does. And we're going to take a little break here. We're going to talk to Beth McDonald, and I call her my astronomical assignment editor.
Ooh.
And Beth, it's great to have you on the program. We're going to talk right now for the next couple of minutes about some special days that have already gone by, but that are also coming up, and this particular time of the year. But Beth, what I want to put to you, because of what you shared in the email as far as letting me know, we have Rosh Hashanah that was on the September the 8th, and on the 10th we had Ramadan, which ended, Yom Kippur, which is, I believe, the Jewish New Year, was on the 17th. Then you have Shukat, and the equinox were on the 23rd, which is interesting. Most people think that it's always on the 21st. Then there's the Chumash harvest season celebration, which is called the Hutash. Basically, it goes on for the most of September. You have several. You have Halloween. How is that pronounced? Saman?
Oh, it so depends on your region. Being from California, I always did the American thing and called it Samhain, but I'm sure the Gaelics pronounce it quite differently.
And speaking of which, there are a bunch of there's seven Catholic holidays.
Right.
And Venus goes into retrograde on October the 8th, which was yesterday, into Scorpio, and goes direct on November the 18th. Now, into Libra. Now, what's interesting is when we talk about Mercury going into retrograde, which we just came out of in September, I am assuming Mercury is now, as you say here, it's now direct?
Direct.
Okay. Give me an understanding of the conglomeration of, we'll call them holidays or holy days, even as the word is kind of edified down, in relation to this time of the year.
Excellent. Yes. Well, first of all, thank you, Richard, for having me here, as always. I love my new job. And I want to thank Mark for, first of all, your words today, but also the work you do in the world. Philosophy teachers I had my freshman and sophomore years of college changed my life.
That's very gracious to hear that. And please tell us more about that.
Oh! Well, that's more of a happy hour conversation than a 14-minute, than I can do right here, right now.
But well, actually, we may have more time in November because she's going to be joining us.
Oh, that's great!
The whole month
right.
of November,
oh,
every Saturday, we're going to be doing readings for people.
Oh, wonderful!
Giving
yeah,
them some
it's
insight.
A mitzvah.
Yeah.
But if your philosophy professors actually changed your life, then you had good professors.
I had good professors. They encouraged me to ask questions, and they showed me things I never knew existed.
Oh my
that's
God!
The Reader's Digest version. Yeah.
And so that's, yeah, go ahead.
So tell us about this time of the year.
Oh, well, the thing that I think is the most important, again, I kind of take a big picture look at things, and from a big picture standpoint, for so many religions and spiritual doctrines and metaphysics and ways of looking at things and however you want to call, you know, I get it, there's a difference between religion and spirituality, but for so many of both camps, this is a very sacred time. I was raised Christian, and so we always look to the winter holiday, you know, the Christmas time, mm-hmm. as being the most sacred. But when I stepped, when I started learning more and being encouraged to ask questions about the nature of beauty and reality and truth and goodness, I found that, you know, there was a lot of other perspectives, and a lot of them pointed towards the fall. The fall is the harvest season, and that is such a rich metaphor. It's the harvest season on the material level and on the emotional level. We're reaping what we have sown, and we're taking stock. So a lot of these celebrations are really about assessment. You know, where am I? Do I have enough to get me through the winter? You know, and what did I do right that got me the things that are good about what I have right now? And what do I need to continue tweaking or altering or working with?
Well, I was trying to stay as mindful as possible during the retrograde phase.
Oh, yes.
Thinking, okay, I'm trying to have an aha moment, but the guy in front of me is not moving fast enough in his car, and I'm getting really irritated. And then, of course, Monday we had that ungodly weather.
Yes.
I thought I was back in Phoenix and fearful of the fact that something dramatic was going to happen beyond the heat.
Yeah, the interesting thing for me about the retrogrades is that it's such a time when the obstacles are revealed.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the obstacle is me.
Yeah.
Or sometimes the obstacle being the guy who's going too slow is revealing the obstacle in me, where it's like, wow, what's wrong with me that I can't just be patient and present with this? You know, or what's wrong with me that I'm leaving late for my appointment and now this guy is really upsetting me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I think the retrogrades are so difficult because they are a time when we are more confronted or more susceptible to confrontations. And the upside of that is if you can be open and if you can continue to ask questions rather than to clamp down, shut down, overreact,
mm-hmm.
Then it is a time of a really rich harvest in terms of all the good things that asking questions gets us.
Yeah.
More enlightenment, more empowerment, more connection to whatever we feel the forces of the universe are and the life force that connects us to those we love.
Exactly. And we'll talk more about this on October the 16th.
Yes,
and then
will.
You'll be joining us on November the 15th. Is that the 15th? The 13th, I'm sorry.
Very
November
good.
The 13th, Saturday. So we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Excellent. Thanks, Richard, and thank you, Mark. And keep
a
up
pleasure
the good work.
A pleasure to meet you and know you.
Thank you so much, you too.
And Beth, to get a hold of you, they can go to what website?
Mine, which is www.bethmcdonaldconsulting.com.
Great. Thank you very much, Beth.
Thank you.
Our astronomical assignment editor.
Wow.
Beth McDonald joins us whenever we're doing the program live to talk about different aspects of whether it's the stars or just events that are occurring, such as holidays.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like there are... I used to think of our calendar in the United States, almost every day is a holiday somewhere in the United States, and it's getting close. But then when you start incorporating all of the various belief systems out there,
yes,
no matter what name you put on it, I mean, I just ran down that list at the beginning of the little segment there with her.
Right.
It's just incredible that there are people who still look to those days. They know the history of it. I remember when I was checking out Hanukkah. My wife and I wanted to learn more about the Jewish traditions, thinking that Hanukkah, because you heard it at the same time as Christmas, that it was this big deal. And I remember talking with a Jewish friend of mine, and they said, well, actually, it's one of the minor holy days. And I'm going, really?
Mm.
It goes on for 8 days. How can that be minor? And of course, he explained how the difference is and so forth.
Yeah.
But it is very interesting how I look back on my life, my childhood in particular, with Christmas, both the secular aspects of it, the presents, but also the religious aspects of it, going to Mass, going to various gatherings. And even to me, part of the spiritual aspects were Christmas caroling with my family throughout the neighborhood. And that neighborhood doesn't exist anymore. And I mean literally, that neighborhood doesn't exist anymore. I can never go home, which is kind of sad in one way, but you know, time marches on. As it does on this program. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm here with Mark McIntyre, and we're going to get back into the subject of philosophy. And we're going to talk a little bit more here. I guess what we'll do is let's go ahead and jump into the conversation that we were kind of having before the program started, and that question that I raised in regards to the arbiters of the faith. I think that's the right word, arbiters. If you will, founding fathers.
The patriarchs and the matriarchs of any religion.
And one of the things that I found so fascinating as I began to learn more about them was how they used religion, the dogma and the doctrine, as a ruler on the knuckles, if you will. I mean, I remember one specific experience that was shared with me from history. They knew about astronomy, and they knew about eclipses, solar and lunar, and they were out amongst the peasants, and they knew there was an eclipse coming. And they told the peasants, as the sky began to darken, that God was angry and was taking away the light. Unless you give alms money, it's going to stay dark. And they were filled with fear and began to give alms. And of course, God began to return the light to the peasants.
Yeah, that's a popular fallacy that we study. We study 17 fallacies in my class, and one of them is called post hoc ergo propter hoc. It's called the false cause fallacy, and I use the example of primitive tribes. When they see an eclipse of the sun, they look at the darkness in the sky, they run into their huts and drag out all these drums and flutes and swords and dance around a fire, and soon enough, well, my goodness, you know, the eclipse goes away. So they falsely attribute that the dancing and the ceremony has the cause of the eclipse going away, and thus they are saved. So you've landed on something very, very important for us to talk about, Richard, and that is that religion should never really be looked at as a substitute for scientific investigation, nor should science. Here's the other shoe going to drop. Nor should science ever be looked upon as a replacement for religion and spirituality, at least. And the reason I say this is because there really isn't any conflict. All scientists, I don't care if they declare that they're the most atheistic people on the planet, any scientist cannot go to their laboratories every day, cannot go to their lecture halls every day, cannot go to their word processors every day without believing in something that cannot be verified by the senses, in other words, by science. So even the most rabid atheistic humanist believes in some idea or set of principles that they think is more valuable to regulate their lives. So that's why religion and science are not at odds, because religion is not so much a knuckle-wrapping ruler as it is supposed to be a guide for living.
Yes.
Now, the fact that you put your finger on the fact that people have abused and hijacked religions. I was talking to Manu Eskandari on my show the other day. We talked about the Muslim experience, the modern experience. He was explaining how modern Islam has been hijacked by both Sunnis and Shias for political purposes. Whenever religion is hijacked by any people, any group of people, and used as a club to beat people over the head, this is against the very principles of the religion itself.
Yeah.
That's what heresy is. That's what, and that's why Dr. Eskandari labeled the Islamic terrorists as heretics. They're not Muslims.
Right.
They're heretics.
Yeah. What I found interesting in my conversations back in my early days with the various religious programmers, I was asking questions that could be conceived as being of an heretical nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wonderful, I will wear the H with a badge as a badge of honor, mm-hmm. because I am not buying the party line, as I used to say,
right?
Because it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make logical sense to me,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, there's another point, there's another aspect to this question,
mm-hmm.
all right? So science and religion can coexist side by side. One does not negate the other.
Right.
What about logic and religion versus logic and science?
Okay, that's a very, very good point. I can create a valid argument to prove to you, a conclusion that all Bostonians are humans, and I can validly arrive at that conclusion using totally factually false premises. People don't understand that having a valid argument, it means very little. It just means that the process of your reasoning is not mistaken. Let me give you the argument, which I give to my students. All light bulbs are human. That's premise number one. Think about that. All light bulbs are human.
And again, we're assuming every statement is true.
Yes, but we know factually it's false.
Okay.
Okay, but we're assuming that it's true. Assuming that it's true that mm-hmm. all light bulbs are human, and assuming the second premise that all Bostonians are light bulbs, what's the only conclusion you can come to?
That Bostonians are human.
Exactly. Now, there's a case. Here's a case I've just demonstrated to you using the principles of logic, not invented by Aristotle, but codified by Aristotle. He didn't invent them.
Mm-hmm.
And you asked me previously, why is Aristotle looked to as a primal thinker, mm-hmm. a primary thinker, a patriarch mm-hmm. in the history of philosophy? This is why. There are certain principles of reasoning, like the one I just gave you. That argument is perfectly valid. And by the way, validity is like pregnancy. It's either valid or not valid. There's no middle way with pregnancy, right?
Right.
I don't know of a woman who said to me, she's half pregnant.
Yeah.
No, doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. You cannot have an almost valid argument.
Right.
That's impossible.
It is or it isn't.
That's right. However, the big issue is, do you have a sound argument?
Mm-hmm.
Is your argument sound? What are the criteria for soundness in an argument? Number one, it's got to be valid.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not saying very much, because I can make a valid argument, as I just did,
yes.
using false premises to arrive at a true conclusion with all the power of validity that Aristotle has instructed me with. Okay. But is the argument sound? No. Why not? Because it has false premises. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All light bulbs are not human. And all Bostonians are not light bulbs, unless you're from New York. in which case, we have a different meaning. We have an equivocation
right.
on the word.
Okay? Right.
So to answer your question substantively, there is no real scientific debating on the dogmas of religion. That is to say, there is no laboratory that we can go into and hook up apparatus and take measurements to find out whether or not Mary, the Blessed Mother of Christ, was a virgin when she conceived.
Right.
That's not possible. Okay. We have no way of taking a bread and wine from a Catholic ceremony after it has been consecrated. There's no way on the planet Earth or on any planet of any kind
right.
ever. To determine whether or not that bread and that wine substantially has changed into the body and blood of Jesus Christ.
Right.
There's no way to do that.
Right.
So it's senseless to argue about that scientifically. You either believe that or you do not believe that.
You cannot argue beliefs.
You cannot argue religious beliefs scientifically, and you cannot argue scientific theories and hypotheses religiously.
Right. I remember
it's a reciprocal thing here.
Yeah.
It's a two-way street.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I did an interesting study after I interviewed a gentleman years ago. John Noe wrote a book called The Apocalypse Conspiracy.
Yes.
Fascinating book.
Good book.
You've read it?
I've read the book.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Great. You're the first person I've met who's read it. I've interviewed him a number of times.
Really? Okay.
Well, I was so intrigued by his premise
mm-hmm.
that I said, you know what? I don't want to be regurgitating John's information.
Right.
I want to have the primary information.
Yeah, but John wasn't giving information.
Well, now this is where
it's
this
not
is,
information.
Well,
see?
here's where I'm coming from.
Go ahead.
Information. If I was going to get into conversations with people
right.
about religious issues,
right.
I would bring this to the forefront. I said, okay, first of all, we have to come to an agreement. First of all, we will. Without argument, we will agree that the Bible is the inerrant word of God, just for the sake of argument.
Exactly.
And then I also need to bring into the mix a concordance, which is mm-hmm. basically a Bible dictionary. And we must also agree that that is authoritative. So we have two documents, and we're going to, because I would be talking mostly with Christians mm-hmm. at this time, and I would say, okay, we've accepted that these two documents are correct.
Right.
Now, in one section of his book, he talks about a passage in the New Testament. The passage goes, paraphrasing here, they will be caught up to meet him in the air in the clouds of glory, referring to the rapture.
Okay.
He focused on one word in that passage, mm-hmm. one word. And he went to his concordance and he looked up that word in the New Testament mm-hmm. in the original language. Now, mm-hmm. there are two definitions for the word air, A-I-R.
Right.
One is the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. The planes fly through it. The mm-hmm. clouds float through it. The other is the breath, breathing. Mm-hmm. God breathed the breath of life into the nostrils of Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And what he found in reference, and this was just one word in that passage,
right,
which
right.
changed everything for him,
mm-hmm.
the definition was not the first one.
Mm-hmm.
The definition was the second one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how can that be?
Mm-hmm.
So then he had to go through and start researching all the other words mm-hmm. and try to understand, well, what is being meant by clouds and glory and them and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And what he began to understand for himself was mm-hmm. that all of this stuff in mm-hmm. this book, the first one, the
mm-hmm.
Bible,
mm-hmm.
for him, it was not literal.
Mm-hmm.
It was more metaphorical, more spiritual,
anybody,
more internal.
Anyone who tries to insist upon a literal interpretation of Scripture, by the way, whose Scripture?
Well,
what
then,
translation
yeah,
of Scripture?
Then we start getting into
there
even
are so
more
many,
arguments.
There are, yeah, somebody says to me, well, it's in the Bible. Well, I say to them, whose Bible?
Which
what
one?
Bible? What
yeah.
translation of a Bible? What fragment? What manuscript are you talking about? Show
mm-hmm.
me the manuscript, because I have studied Hebrew and mm-hmm. classical Greek, and I could probably read the manuscript.
Yeah.
And we could talk about that.
Sure.
Okay? But don't tell me the Bible
right.
and tell me that this is some universally accepted
yeah.
Written document. It is not. It is an interpreted historically evolved document that relates the metaphoric response that certain people have had, called Christians and Jews in our tradition,
mm-hmm.
The Judeo-Christian heritage, their response to life
right.
and their response to reality,
right.
truth, goodness, and beauty.
But see, that I think is where we as a society, specifically in America, have been derailed, because our educational system doesn't teach logical thinking and critical thinking, problem solving,
yeah.
and I just...
Did you know that critical thinking is mandated by the California state statutes?
Really?
Yes. And you know why? Because in the 70s, when I was teaching back east, the inmates took over the asylum. The students took over the universities and started writing the curriculum plans. The students started voting on faculty tenures. And the result is that they stripped away something called the liberal arts core. It used to be the case that you could not get a liberal arts degree without taking a philosophy class, without taking a music class, without taking an art class. You couldn't get it.
Yeah.
Today, I know PhDs. Remember now what that meant.
Uh-huh.
We talked about
right?
that.
Mm-hmm.
I know masters, people who hold PhDs and hold master's degrees, and they don't know the distinction between validity and soundness.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why I'm not fully appreciated by some of my colleagues is that I would send my students out to other professors on the campus and say, go to your professor in psychology or history or economics or sustainability and bring back some argument that they say belongs to their discipline. They would come back with fragments of arguments. They would come back with sound bites. They would come back with bumper stickers. Very few. And there were few, by the
mm-hmm.
way. Very, there were few. But the students were appalled to realize that we have generations after generation of, and I told you at the beginning of the show, philosophers have fallen down and not done their job.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'm talking
mm-hmm.
about. Philosophers have not insisted that everybody play by the same set of argumentative rules. We now have students and faculty who say, oh, if it's true for me, it must be true. I beg your pardon?
Uh-huh.
Is that a neurologist that you really want to go under the knife to?
2 + 2 is not 4. It's what the group says it is.
Yeah, right. And just one word on this. Up until about from the beginning of philosophy in the West up until the time of René Descartes, the philosophy was outer directed towards objectivity. The pursuit was that there's an objective world out there and we can know it with our minds and with our bodies. We can know the objective world. Descartes simply turned the whole ship 180 degrees around and said, oh no, it's all happening in the noodle. It's all happening between our ears. So the whole world philosophically spun around 180 degrees towards what we now call subjectivity. And there comes the whole modern philosophical pursuit that tells us, called postmodernism and post-existentialism, postmodernism, that there is no reality, there is no truth, there is no goodness, and there is no beauty. There is only what we think those things are.
Because when we start labeling them, we're placing judgment, and then we go off into
it. We can't do that.
Oh, gosh, no.
Oh, no.
I have two more questions to ask you, and we have 4 minutes.
Oh, my God. Go ahead.
Why is philosophy important in our world today and creating the world of tomorrow?
Richard, it's the only discipline where you get to ask the most fundamental questions about any topic. In any discipline, any class you take, the professor is going to assume... he's going to assume something very basic that is really a philosophically debatable issue. And philosophy is unless you get to the assumptions on any discipline, on any topic, you're not going to make any progress in knowing. And that's why it's important to do now, and that's why it's going to be important in the future. Because we can't figure things out if we're using incorrect processes of reasoning. And it's happening all the time.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Happening all the time.
It's just drives me crazy.
What's your second question?
You're a very passionate man when it comes to philosophy.
Yes, I am.
Why this? Why now?
I was mentored by loving, kind, caring, compassionate, and brilliant professors and teachers. They inculcated within me a respect for others' opinions and a respect for the classical tradition of thought. And they also did one final thing. They inculcated within me a spirit to pass that on. It is my duty and my responsibility to pass what I know, or what I think I know, on to another generation or future generations of people, because that is how the human species evolves their consciousness.
So you have taken the charge for your legacy.
Exactly.
To the future.
Exactly. And I thank my mentors. I thank those who have made it difficult for me, because the more difficult they made it for me, the more they sharpened my mind.
Yeah. I never took philosophy. It sounds to me like it would have been a wonderful thing to have taken for debating.
You don't need to. You're already a philosopher, so why do you need to take philosophy? You're a natural-born philosopher. You ask questions, Richard, that any philosophy student would ask in any philosophy classroom. So you don't need to take any classes. Just keep doing what you're doing, reading, discussing, probing other people's minds, getting other people's points of view. That's what's important.
If you have time following this broadcast, we do something called the Afterview for 15 to 30 minutes, and it's not available to the general public unless you go to the website and you listen to this interview, and it'll be at the tail end of this interview. Would that be something that you'd be open to?
Absolutely.
All right, then. You folks now know that this program will continue on the website at richarddugan.com. And this interview will be placed up there, and you will be able to listen to our conversation as we continue talking. So I encourage you to go to richarddugan.com.
What a great idea.
And listen to this interview and listen to our conversation following, because I'm going to put that at the end of the program as we wrap up here with the last 45 seconds of the live broadcast. And you and I will continue on for 15 or 30 minutes or so.
Wonderful. I love it.
And go from there.
This is a little velvet rope that you give to people, isn't
it?
You're very clever. You get good marketing skills.
I have to say that it came to mind about a year or two ago, because I thought, we can't end it here.
Right.
And even
right.
those 15 or 30 minutes right. aren't going to be enough. But nonetheless, right. I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me and sharing your audience. I appreciate it.
And I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices. Until next Saturday at 3 p.m. when we broadcast live and stream live on the internet at richarddugan.com, Love Talal. And we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and I am still in studio, joined by Mark McIntyre. We're talking about philosophy, and you're marveling a little bit of how we can do this so seamlessly,
this
straight
yeah.
into the afterview.
What I can see in my mind now is all these people running to their computers, getting the stream and getting the whole thing going there and getting on. And
I think that it's
a good idea.
You always want to try to encourage people if they're interested in what you're talking about.
Right.
And there's more to talk about. There always is more to talk
about.
Well, we
always leave something on the table.
Yeah.
You and I mean, you have your show, I have my show, and I always feel after my show that my guest, I want to invite him back right away because we left something on the table.
Oh, yeah.
What did we leave on the table here?
Well, we left on the table the aspect of philosophy as a way of life.
Yes.
Can one live a philosophical life as opposed to someone who has lived their who is living their life, say, entrenched in, say, politics or their given religion or a particular pursuit? I mean, yes, you're a philosophy instructor. I mean, and you're I'm more than that, because you're immersed in it. It's who and what you are. So maybe my question is sort of answered yes, but how do we do that?
Oh, the answer is yes. Yes. There's no question that you can live a meaningful existence from the time that you become conscious about philosophy and its distinction from religion and spirituality, incorporating those or not incorporating those, your decision, from that time until you draw your last breath on this planet. You can certainly live a life of a philosopher. And what that entails is I do it every day. Every day I get up, I have quiet time in the morning at about 5:30, 6 o'clock. I find a quiet place. I do a little bit of reading for nourishment. And then I turn over. I ask myself this question. What is your concept of reality? What is your concept of truth? What is your concept of beauty? And what is your concept of goodness? And you know what? It's slightly different every day. It changes. What changes it? The experiences that I've had the previous day, the concerns, the projection of what the day may be like, the successes, the failures, the vexations, the trials, the accomplishments, the dreams, the hopes, the ambitions, all of that shapes and changes the answers to those questions I face every single morning. Once I've focused on those questions, I can then plan my day and I can accept whatever comes my way.
There were two phrases that were given to me very early on in my life that I've remembered to this day. One of them I remember humorously and has actually helped me doing these programs. And one of them is, it is better keep silent that rather than open thy mouth and
prove that you're a fool.
And prove that you're a fool. And so I've used that in these interviews.
You know, the older I get, the more I realize that that applies to me.
Well, and
Mark,
I'm,
shut up.
Well, it's taught me to try to back off, because certainly everybody has a lot to say.
Yeah.
But see, this program isn't about me.
Right.
It's about my guests and what they have to
and
say.
And that's why your program is successful, because you do get out of the way.
I try.
Yeah, you get out of the way.
And the other one, if I can recall it now, it's now escaped my mind, but it has to do along those same lines. It is better to begin in doubt and end in certainty than to begin in certainty and end in doubt. Now, is that a philosophical phrase statement?
Yeah, it's a philosophically framed and formulated statement, and the reason why it rings so successfully is because it expresses a relationship between ideas that is reciprocal. Philosophers often do this, and that's why we have sound bites and quotable quotes. And the quote that you just made is particularly resonant, because it expresses something that we say, oh yeah, I know what that means. I've done that.
Yeah.
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 Now, I've studied Chardin.
Théod de Chardin, Jesuit, French Jesuit, wrote a marvelous series of books. Unfortunately, the church forbade him to publish, and he accepted that as a Jesuit priest. He's an example of one of the most marvelous clerics I have ever encountered in my existence. I never met Théo de Chardin, but I read all of his works when I was studying philosophy. He influenced my generation of philosophy to an enormous extent.
Yeah,
I would say Søren Kierkegaard. That's how the Danes pronounce it. We say Kierkegaard because mm-hmm. we pronounce the D. But Søren Kierkegaard and Théo de Chardin, his book, The Phenomenon of Man,
mm-hmm.
has to be one of the most exciting, interesting, philosophically pregnant books because he actually proposed a replacement for the Aristotelian distinction between matter and spirit.
Mm.
And the church couldn't deal with it. The Catholic Church couldn't deal with it. It was too bold, too broad, too extreme. And they said, hold it. Whoa. Yeah. Back up, baby. Back up.
It didn't fit inside their box.
Well, no. And the reason why is because I don't know if a lot of people know this, but I do because it's my profession. But the reason why the Catholic Church became so dogmatic for so long and remained dogmatic was because they took the philosophy of Aristotle and used it as the skeleton to put the flesh of their theology on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like to explain it with that metaphor to my students.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Aquinas, the great Summa Theologica, Thomas Aquinas author, he was the one who supplied the church with this marvelous incorporation of the Aristotelian metaphysics and physics and cosmology to explain Catholic dogma and Catholic theology. That allowed the church to explain its theology for centuries later. That's where the wars come in. Okay, that's where the wars come in, and that's where science comes in, because science goes, oh, wait a minute, Aristotle says that something can't be in two places at one time. What about this photoelectric plate and this photon here?
Yeah.
Ooh. So, in other words, Aristotle was perfectly useful for the Catholic Church to use as the basis of its explanation of reality until we had phenomenon of experience through science that contradicted the basic physics of Aristotle, the tabletop physics of Aristotle.
But even that's a problem within dogma and doctrine of religion.
That's why religion should never be, they should not cling tenaciously to their cosmologies.
Right.
All religions have a cosmology, which is how the universe began and how it operates and the mechanics of it. This is why Chardin is so important, because he comes along and he says, look, church, the gas that Aquinas put in the tank for your theology, we're running on fumes here, okay? We're not going to make it to the next pit stop, okay?
Yeah.
We need another metaphysics. We need a physics that says that our word matter and our word energy and our word spirit, they're not different kinds of entities.
Yeah.
They're simply different facets and phases of the same thing.
Yeah. It's like ice, water, and steam.
Right. And the church said, oh, pantheism, oh my God. No. So they were afraid that he was tending towards pantheism, which would be heretical to the Catholic Church. And indeed, if they had let the poor man publish, they would have worked this out, and Chardin probably would have saved the church another couple of centuries.
But it also comes down to education. If
right.
you don't allow the populace to be educated, and I mean really not indoctrinated, but educated, then they get to be more self-determining and or understanding of what the church
is. I was educated in Catholic schools all of my life, and I wouldn't change one day of it. I don't regret it, and they gave me a marvelous nurturing of my mind, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. So the irony here is that Catholic education is one hell of a good education.
It can be, absolutely.
It can be if
absolutely.
It's done correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, you have so many people who have abused their powers of authority over the minds, especially psychologically, in some cases, horribly enough, even physically, and you have catastrophic results of this.
Yeah.
So that the people who would profit by something, they're destroyed by something.
Yeah, You know,
that's the pity.
What I find fascinating too is regarding education, as we kind of spin off into this direction with philosophy. I'm in the process right now, up on where I live, of cutting down a dead tree. it's been there for a year. It was destroyed by the bark beetle, but the wood is still good enough to use in the fireplace.
Okay,
and so I've been doing some internet searching. I've talked with some people who cut trees down, and I've gotten some guidance and so forth. I wasn't real good at geometry, but I absolutely understand the methodology that has been explained to me both via the internet and individuals as to how to bring this tree down where I want so that I don't get hurt, nothing gets destroyed, and I can then collect the wood for the winter. But if you were to bring in a geometry professor, they could diagram out how this all happens using that discipline of geometry.
Right.
What is missing in our educational system today, aside from the basics, is there is no practical. It kind of goes back to the argument, well, when am I going to use this in my life?
Right.
Well, guess what? I'm now 50. Well, we do use it every day, right, even in broadcasting. Mm-hmm. But I'm now 50, and I'm now using the concepts or the constructs, if you will, even though I couldn't map it out with a compass and slide rule to save my life.
Right.
But I understand how these concepts work because of the way it's been explained to me. Mm-hmm. Is philosophy in that same kind of boat where in some schools it's just being taught rote memorization kind of situation where read the book and there's a test. As opposed to some kind of dialogue? Well, because you're doing internet instructing.
Exactly.
How is there dialogue in that regard so that the students are really learning?
Right. Well, there's the false perception that in order for someone to learn, they have to have a dialogue.
Okay.
That's a false perception.
Okay.
It's not necessarily the case. An online class is a very tough way to learn. I'll grant you that. And it's not for everyone. We used to think that it was for everyone.
It's almost like a correspondence course.
It's even more rigid than that because the mortality rate that we have in online classes is upward of 50% by the time we finish the course, upwards of 50%. And the reason is because we haven't taught students how to independently think and research and ponder and ask good questions. We haven't taught that. The asking of questions is primal. We had Professor Joe White on my show, Minds That Matter.
Yes.
We had him on there, and he's writing a whole book about the erotetic logic, the logic of asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
We don't teach that. They need to read Joe's book because that's what we need. The other thing is that philosophy has become falsely equivocated with logic, especially symbolic logic, especially mathematical logic, especially statistics. Nothing could be further from the case. And this is where philosophers have let down on their responsibility. We had President Gail Beebe on from Westmount. He gave the most articulate presentation of the defense of the liberal arts core, which is the trivium and the quadrivium. It begins with grammar, and then it goes to rhetoric, and then it goes to logic. If you don't understand language, and these are the things you should learn first.
Mm-hmm.
Our educational system is completely upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of teaching people what to think, we need to be teaching them
how to think. Hello.
Because if the process is screwed up, the results are going to be screwed up.
I saw this back in the 80s, and they were talking about the dumbing down of our educational system back then. And my mind began to process 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years down the road. And I thought, okay, wait a minute. All right. We have textbooks in 1980 that the students are learning from. Fairly good textbooks, a little critical. Some people are critical of certain parts, but overall, the textbooks are good. But if the system is in decline, these kids who are in high school and even in college, and now they're taking their educational degrees, some of these people
are going to go on to write textbooks, and they're part of the process.
Unfortunately.
Okay.
Unfortunately,
all right. Yeah. So follow the logic mm-hmm. here. And I thought, okay, so now we have products of the system that is in decline mm-hmm. who are writing the books for the new system of the 90s that's in decline mm-hmm. For these students who are now going to be coming up, and they're going to be learning from the books from the kids from the 80s. Mm-hmm. And then the 90s kids are mm-hmm. coming up into the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And again, the slope is still sliding downhill. Mm-hmm. And now we might as well be putting comic books in the classrooms
right.
for all the good it'll do us. Because
I call these
just the learning materials
yeah.
are so inferior.
Yeah, they're inept.
Yeah. yeah.
And you know the reason why? Is because having gotten rid of the academics are kind of smug about this. The academic community is kind of smug. They call themselves progressives because they think that, well, we're too sophisticated to believe in God anymore. We don't have God. You must be stupid if you believe in God, you know. Only morons and nincompoops, you see. Well, we're scientific. We're progressives. Mm. And what they mean by that is, They have thrown out a sacred religion, but they have imported what I call secular religion.
Yeah,
you want to get? I'll give you an idea. We're obsessed with strange permutations of gender combinations.
Yes,
we're obsessed with this new thing called sustainability. Nobody can tell me what that is. I have asked all of these sustainability gurus what sustainability means, but you know what? That has become the buzzword. How many times a day do you hear the word sustainability?
Yeah.
And no one can tell you what it means.
Yeah.
Sustainable for whom? Sustainable according to what? Sustainable why? Remember the word diversity. Diversity.
Yes,
as though if there were a Buddhist Eskimo and an iron lung in my classroom, I would have a diverse classroom.
Yeah.
Whether they participated or not, mere presence
yeah.
of a wide permutation and combination of entities,
yeah.
that in itself is an improvement. People got their PhDs, people wrote textbooks, people got deanships, they got presidencies, they got jobs, they got money, they got grants, all from what I call secular theology.
Yeah. Two other things I want to get to before we wrap this up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to list them both, but I want to focus on one of them first.
Well, you go.
I want to talk about mythology.
Oh, good.
And I want to talk about Idiocracy, the
Ooh.
Movie.
The movie.
Have you seen it?
Yes.
Okay, then
yes.
you know what. Okay.
Yes.
We're going to talk about mythology first. A good friend of mine, early in my career again, he and I used to talk all the time
mm-hmm.
about great television program, mm-hmm. great movies that
right.
were made from the TV show,
right.
and then another series that came along after that, and another series after that.
Mm-hmm.
And what his mind was so I began to look at this television program and the movies from his mindset, and
right.
I could see it.
Right.
He said that our modern mythology was the Star Trek series
mm-hmm.
of experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to point to one episode from The Next Generation with John Patrick Stewart and Jean-Luc Picard,
mm-hmm.
where you had the various species
mm-hmm.
searching the galaxy for these bits and pieces of DNA
mm-hmm.
to put them together
mm-hmm.
and they put them into the tricorder, and then they were on this planet all kind of arguing one another, and suddenly somebody hit the button
mm-hmm.
and up pops this creature
right.
in a hologram. Ah, I am here because you've all come together in love and unity and so on mm-hmm. and so on and so on. You've
mm-hmm.
progressed and on and on and on. And the only one I could see who really was coming close to understanding what they had just done was the captain,
mm-hmm.
was Picard.
Mm-hmm.
All the others thought it was supposed to be this grand weapon and so forth. And I thought, yeah, in a way, that's kind of what we're trying to do. We're trying
mm-hmm.
to understand and tell one another, you're part of me and I'm part of you. We're all one.
Right.
We're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
I affect you. You affect me and so on and so forth. And the metaphysics of spirituality and other religions. I mean, even Christianity talks about, you know, how we're all supposed to be serving one God, and so we all are following one ruler,
right.
and we're taking those commands.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not me. It's him. I did it because he told me to.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
What role does mythology How does mythology play into philosophy? Mm-hmm. I mean, both of them, I wish I had studied them in school because I feel like I've missed so much.
You're quite right. Gail Beebe and I were talking about this, and I talk about this with my friends in the film industry. I'm bringing Fraser Heston up to talk. He's a filmmaker, son of Charlton Heston.
Oh, yes.
And we're going to be talking on air, Minds That Matter, and we're going to talk about this. To answer your question directly, let's start with the direct answer. Myth is the grandmother of both philosophy and theology.
Oh.
Myth is the grandmother.
Okay.
Okay. Without that grandmother, we wouldn't have philosophy. And philosophy actually went through an intermediary stage called cosmology. All right. So from myth, then there were cosmological myths. For those of you who are not familiar with the word, I shouldn't be using a technical word. Cosmos. Just think of the word cosmos.
Yeah.
And cosmology is a basic set of ideas about the origins of the universe and basically how the universe operates and whether or not the universe is coming to an end. Maybe, maybe not. That's cosmology. Mm-hmm. Okay. There are cosmological myths. In India, there are Nordic myths, there are Vedic myths, there are Greco myths, there mm-hmm. are Roman myths.
The various Indian tribes of the Americas have their own myths.
And this is why Tolkien, okay, is mm-hmm. such a popular read. Thank you to one of my students, Matthew Bixby, who he wore out 3 baseball bats beating me over the head before I finally read Tolkien, because I'm just an obstinate, stubborn person mm-hmm. sometimes. And I, you know, anyway, but Tolkien, who was Tolkien? A professor of mythology.
Okay.
Okay. Professor of mythology. You want to have a great conversation? Get a professor of mythology someday and sit down. And there are some really good ones around, by the way. I met one the other day. And they're wonderful people because they understand that without myth, we don't really have a story to tell. The name of your program is Tell Me Your Story, mm-hmm. right? Well, without myth, humanity really has no story to tell. Really has no story.
And why is that?
Because myth is our way of probing into the unknown, going where no man has gone before. I'm serious about it.
Okay.
Look at Avatar, the film, how successful the film Avatar is.
Uh-huh.
And many people thought that was either a Western or a new myth, a new mythology.
Yeah.
But if you read Tolkien, if you take Tolkien seriously, what he does is he amalgams Nordic mythology, Greco-Roman mythology, Middle Eastern theology, Indian theology, Pakistani, African, and he melts all of those down and creates languages, creates kingdoms, creates forces and powers and entities that just thrill the mind. Far better than any philosophy could, far better than any theology could, because it captures the imagination of what is possible.
Mm. Would, and again, a sidebar here.
Yeah.
Would the Dune trilogies by Frank Herbert kind of fall under that same kind of category?
To a lesser extent,
okay.
because I don't think it's deep enough. It doesn't probe deep enough, but you're certainly right, and I hate to use the pun here, on the surface of things.
Right, right. Well, and since I haven't read Tolkien myself.
Yeah. I got to get the baseball bat. I'll get Matthew Bixby to beat you
I'll
over
have to
the
get
head.
It on CD.
Yeah, you'll get it.
What I find fascinating is, it has been said, and you can correct me if I'm incorrect, that in every myth there is some truth. We may not know what it is, but there is some grain of truth. It really did happen, but not quite the way the mythology says it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, to the extent that you're using the word truth in a very rarefied and very specialized meaning,
mm-hmm.
yes, you're right. And the rarefied and specialized meaning that I think that you're referring to, and again, correct me if I'm wrong,
mm-hmm.
is that the inclination of people to know with certainty, to figure out meaning and purpose, that mythology does actually provide us with a glimpse of truth
mm-hmm.
because it appeals to what we call human universals. Now, I know some of my colleagues don't believe in human universals. I do.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to believe in human universals. That is to say, I do not know anthropologically of any group of people on the planet, any anthropological group that wakes up in the morning and says, let's kill our parents. You know, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Oh, those sick people over there, let's dump them in the lake. Let's get rid of those people
mm-hmm.
there. Oh, and, you know, I don't know of any, there are human universals. There is respect for respect for forebears. There is respect for the elderly. There's respect for the sick and the dying. There is nurturing of children. There is respect for the weak in society. Even archaeologists are turning up, even in caveman settings, people were nurtured back to health. There were yeah. attempts to heal the sick or the wounded. So yes, myth does touch human universals, and you can go and deny human universals if you want. If you think we're all just a bunch of wires destined for the trash bin of history, the cosmological dung heap, which most postmodernists, that's their conclusion. We're just a bunch of wires. It doesn't make any difference what any of us thinks because we're all headed for the cosmological dung heap.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that flies in the face of what we know.
Before we go on to Idiocracy,
yeah.
I want to ask you. I want to say something,
yeah.
and I want you to sort of analyze it a little bit. It's a philosophy, I guess, that I live by,
mm-hmm.
That I came about through my early years in Christian broadcasting.
Okay,
again, the greatest education I was ever paid for. truly, even though I wasn't paid much, it was great to be paid to learn all of these things about
yes.
human behavior, sociology, comparative religions, because I wasn't just I was comparing the sects, as I called them, of religion, of Christianity, mm-hmm. and so forth. But what the conclusion that I came to was that I have come to at present,
mm-hmm.
and again, even mine are changing. I told my sister that at one Thanksgiving dinner, and that was a mistake. I said that my beliefs of yesterday are not my beliefs of today, are not my beliefs of tomorrow, because mm-hmm. I'm constantly experiencing.
And a big row ensued when you said that.
And a big row, and my parents said, hey, this is not the place. This is Thanksgiving dinner. Shut up. And we did.
Why is that true of Thanksgiving dinners?
Oh.
The greatest family arguments I can remember were Thanksgiving dinner.
But, you know, there are times when you can have good,
I know.
Good arguments
I
in
know.
That context.
But anyway, continue.
My belief is that my existence is not an accident. Now, I believe that because of an inner knowing. And so I believe that because if I didn't believe that my life had meaning, then I could go out and I could rape and pillage and plunder mm-hmm. and it wouldn't matter because this is all an accident. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something inside of mm-hmm. me that says my life has meaning.
And you're very correct to identify it as a fundamental belief that
right.
you have.
Right. But it's a belief that is stemming from something inside of me that's telling me that.
And you
and that's not a belief.
Well,
there's like that little voice.
You said that it's connected to something that you know. And here's the thing that you know that connects the belief.
Okay.
Yourself. No one can know you,
mm-hmm.
Richard.
Right.
Knowledge of other minds. In philosophy, there's a whole section of philosophy that deals with this issue. It's called knowledge of other minds or the problem of minds. And that's the reason why nobody can make that judgment that your beliefs are either sincere or insincere, unless, of course, your actions contradict
right.
those beliefs. That's right. a different story.
In other words, I go out, rape and pillage and plunder.
Right, right. But if we're both in a monastery somewhere and you espouse these beliefs and you live accordingly, there's no way for me to know whether or not you're sincere.
Hmm.
None.
Mm. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because I haven't been put to, quote-unquote, the test
right.
of my beliefs.
There's a consistency between your behavior and your principles and values. And as long as that is the case, there is no way for us to suspect that you're either insincere about that.
I remember, and to that, I remember I was in a study group for a number of years back in Phoenix mm-hmm. with a group called it was Omega Vector and became Delta Vector. They were the ones who were studying Chardin's work.
Ah,
okay. I'll have to show you the notebook mm-hmm. of all of the pages. There's a wonderful poem in there, as a matter of fact, by Tiberius, I believe was his name, having to do with the gods, and they were conversing over the man and how man is working towards trying to be like us.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And so they began to contemplate, where will we hide the truth from man? I mean, we've got to hide this. And they said, well, we'll hide it in the stars. No, he'll find a way to get there.
Right.
We'll hide it in the depths of the ocean. No, he'll find a way to get down there. And
right.
And again, they go through all top highest mountain
right.
and this and that. Finally, one of them said, I know where we'll hide it. We'll hide it in the heart of man. Mm-hmm. He'll never go there. But to this end of the aspects of the movie Idiocracy, which mm-hmm. I've seen a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I saw it, I laughed, but it scared the daylights out of me because what I was seeing was our potential future.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't see it as mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what are we going to do?
Mm-hmm.
That is a comedy, but and that's how most people are going to see it because
mm-hmm.
I don't know, because of their educational level,
mm-hmm.
Their lack of awareness and understanding and mm-hmm. consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
What's your perspective on that? And we'll call it the real world out here.
I'm not worried.
Okay.
I guess because I'm an Irish Irish extraction and descent, there's an old Irish expression which many of your listeners have heard. There's no sense in being Irish if you're not completely willing to accept the fact that eventually the world will break your heart. The Irish. The
Is that
Irish,
from Bates or Gates?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. It's an ancient
mm-hmm.
Irish saying. It
yeah.
goes back to the time of St. Patrick. Sigmund Freud once remarked that the Irish are the only people who are absolutely immune from psychoanalysis.
Really?
Yes. And do you know why?
Why? I mean, that was going to be my next question.
Well, Thomas Cahill explains it in his fabulous book, How the Irish Saved Civilization.
No.
He quotes Freud, and then he says, the reason is because the Irish do not take themselves seriously.
Well, see, that's my feeling, is that mm-hmm. if the British left Northern Ireland, yes, the Irish would fight amongst themselves, but then they would all
right.
sit down and have a Guinness together.
Right. But the British, unfortunately, have never accepted human nature.
Mm.
And to their everlasting dismay, they have not. The Irish, on the other hand, because of St. Patrick, and Cahill explains this brilliantly in the book. We should do a show about that sometime,
oh, yeah.
or talk about that sometime, mm-hmm. at least with your listeners. Cahill explains that the Irish never thought, and still to this day do not think, there's any conflict between the full, lush enjoyment of the flesh and the body and the life of the mind and the soul. They see no problem with the both happening at the same time.
Yeah.
It's the Augustinian, St. Augustine, who introduced to the West the idea that the body's bad,
yeah.
flesh is evil,
yeah.
oh, you must flagellate yourself, you must go fast and things. That's
yeah.
Augustinian. That's
yeah.
the Augustinian tradition, as opposed to the St. Patrick tradition, which, you know, is isolated there in Ireland.
Yeah.
And that's why the Irish are so distinctively different as Catholics from
yeah.
The other Catholics. They don't suffer a great deal of guilt because they don't take themselves that seriously.
And that's very important.
My grandfather once told me that guilt is the interest paid on a debt that you never owed in the first place. I'll repeat that. Guilt is the interest paid on a debt that you never owed in the first place.
Oh, I love that.
And he was an Irish.
Put that on a t-shirt.
And a coffee cup.
There's a great, I had this wonderful shirt, a green shirt with a gold yellow writing from a poem by Yeats, paraphrasing here, that, you know, that most of my life is made up of worry and stress and strife, only broken up by moments of happiness.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Right.
And I used to wear that all the time because for some dumb reason, that's how I was living.
To answer your question about Idiocracy, I'm optimistic. I'm not a pessimist. There's always room for choice.
Mm-hmm.
There's always room for choice. And everyone faces vexations. Everyone has hardships. Everyone has difficulties. It's how you handle it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's how you handle it. If you if you call a pity party and sit on, anyone can sit on a curb and say, "Oh, poor pitiful me," and give you a long syllabus as to why your life sucks.
Yeah.
Well, I got news for you. Okay, pick the person that you think is the happiest person in the world. Mm-hmm. Spend 15 minutes with that person, and they'll tell you all their vexations.
Yes, they will.
You know.
By the way, anybody that tells you on querying them. So how was your trip with your family to Disneyland? And they say, oh, it was great. They're lying.
Right. Exactly.
Because that's not the whole truth.
That's right.
Now, before we wrap up, there was a conclusion that I came to back in my early years again.
Yes.
When I was such a wee lad in the business. I was perplexed by the statement that Christianity was the only way, or that Catholicism was the only way, or
right.
the, whatever form
the true
of
religion.
Protestant.
The true
right,
religion.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is how I was able to logically come out of that
right.
mindset.
Right.
When we come into this world, there are hundreds of thousands of different foods that we can ingest, both solid and liquid.
Mm-hmm.
When we are of age to go to school in an ideal educational system,
thank you.
There are a multitude of directions that we can go as we progress through that system, through specific disciplines that are of a liking to us, that resonate with us, that mm-hmm. we flow with, and we will go in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
There are a myriad of places that we can travel to on the planet. And at present, there are roughly just shy of 7 billion people minus one self mm-hmm. that we can meet. It seemed inconceivably, arrogant and illogical mm-hmm. to assume, mm-hmm. I say assume, mm-hmm. that one religion is the only way with the plethora of all of the other examples that I've given.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I have not just been doing this program, mm-hmm. but as I have gone through down my path and, of course, done through that study group and met a myriad of different people mm-hmm. and so forth, and then doing this program, mm-hmm. have realized that all of these belief systems all have a common thread in them. Ergo, there is no one. They are all part of the whole in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where I came from. I came out of that. And then my general manager, when I left, said that I was a casualty of Christian broadcasting, which I thought was real interesting.
You're no casualty of Christian broadcasting, Richard. You have a fertile and active mind. You're a seeker and a searcher for truth, goodness, reality, and beauty. You have the philosophical spirit in what you do as a person and certainly what you do with the show. All guests are welcome here from a wide variety of points. You really do have something missing in many colleges. You have ideological diversity, not skin tone diversity,
yeah.
not gender diversity. You have true ideology and that true diversity, and that is that you welcome the exploration of ideas. You have a thriving life of ideas.
Thank you. We're trying, and our point here, I don't know if this is part of Chardin's philosophy or not, is there's an event going on in the center of a circle, and we are all points on that circle. And all I'm trying to do is get all of us, myself included, to move to different points around that circle to see that event differently, to expand. And weren't we told as children in school, after school or on a Saturday, go to the library and read a book to do what? Broaden your horizons. That's all we're trying to do here.
Exactly.
I want to thank you so much. How can people get a hold of you?
MarkMcIntyre.com is my website. And thank you for asking, by the way. Mother always said spell it. It's MarkMcIntyre. There's no Y in my McIntyre.
Okay.
No A in McIntyre either. So they can go on there and they can listen to the archives of my show, Minds That Matter.
Minds That Matter
Minds
with
that
me, Mark McIntyre.
And you taught me to say, I am Mark McIntyre instead of this is Mark McIntyre.
Well, and
sometimes I slip, though.
Well, it's okay. Because we're all learning and
right.
and trying to raise ourselves up to a new level.
Right. By the way, I'm one of the few professors at City College that I do not use public taxpayer-funded facilities to teach online. I pay for my own website out of my own pocket. I run it myself. It's never gone down. Yeah. No student of mine has ever lost an email, ever, or ever been denied access to an exam, unlike a lot of cases I could cite. I pay for it myself. So if you want to go to markmcintyre.com, my entire course is open to the public. There's no passcode, no entry. Go there. The entire course is laid out for you there, and email me, and we'll have a nice chat that way, or we'll meet for coffee.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we will have a link on our website, richarddugan.com, to your website.
Well, it's going to be a reciprocal link because I'm going to put one on mine.
Yeah. I have to say that these kinds of conversations are energizing, mm-hmm. whether I've learned a damn thing or not.
You always, one of my most illustrious mentors taught me once that you always feel better. And he used the word feel very, very seldom. He never used the word feel unless he was talking about something very special. He said, you always feel better when you are reaching into the unknown and putting yourself at risk at the same time.
Wow. I hadn't thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we talk an awful lot in that study group about the great void.
It's a risk.
The great void.
It's a risk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been fun.
Thanks very much.
We will do it again.
We will do it again.
In 2011.
No, before that, I hope.
Well,
That's right. Yeah,
we're booked up. Yeah, well, wow. We're coming to the end of the year, and we're booked up through the end of the year.
I want to thank your listeners for putting up with me, and I look forward to listening to more of your shows, and please stop by mine, Minds That Matter. We're on Wednesday from 2 to 3, but go to markmcintyre.com and you can listen to all the great guests that I've been able to have on my show. I'm very privileged to have these people on my show.
I was fortunate to produce the program with Bibi.
Yes.
And I sat there, I'm going, my head was hurting. My head was hurting and I didn't understand a word you guys said. No,
I saw him yesterday, by the way, at Westmount College. We were talking about that. And I ran into Bob Bryant from Bryant's Jewelry Store and he said, I listened to it 3 times and I still don't understand what you guys were talking about.
Well, but see, that is.
But he said I felt good about it.
Well, believe it or not, I did too because I'm not dead yet, so I can access these pieces.
Exactly.
It's like the comedy of Dennis Miller. I would always tell people, Dennis Miller, he's the comedian. He's the guy who uses obscure historical references, but they're only obscure to me because I don't know them.
Exactly.
But there's still room for learning, and that's what we're trying to do here.
Let's do this again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I'm Richard Dugan, and you're listening to Tell Me Your Story: New Paradigms for a New World. Go to MarkMcintyre.com. He will be linked to our website. You can go to the radio show's page and as you have to listen to the after view. And once again, my thanks to Mark McIntyre. I'm Richard Dugan, and I encourage you to send me an email, richarddugan.com. Go to the website, go to the radio show's page, and listen live every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time as we bring you Tell Me Your Story. Until next Saturday, love Talal.